how concerned do we need to be about the Zika virus?
Does physical therapy help patients with Parkinson's disease?
A common heart condition that's worse for women than for men.
And cancer care near end of life.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on January 22nd, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we have to talk about the Zika virus first. That's from a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention awareness brief, let me call it that, talking about, wow, this mosquito-borne infection and its impact with regard to fetal defects.
This has reached the news because there's been a Zika virus outbreak worldwide, and we'll talk about where those locations are. And as you identified, for women who develop Zika virus infection, it's been associated with fetal abnormalities, mainly microcephaly or a small head, and actually calcifications in the brain as well. As you mentioned, it is a mosquito-borne disease, just like dengue or chikungunya virus. And this mosquito is in certain areas of the world. Particularly, Zika virus infection has been noticed in East South America, Brazil, Uruguay, Ecuador, Paraguay, in certain parts of Africa, West Africa, India, Pakistan, and some Southeast Asian islands. It's oftentimes a very mild disease. Some of the symptoms would include fever, joint pain, or rash. It's particularly problematic for women who are pregnant. So the current recommendation is for women who are pregnant not to travel to places where there's been outbreaks of this virus. What about women that have already traveled there? If they've had symptoms, it's recommended they be tested. That's a blood test. It's not routinely done. That blood's sent off to the CDC. Now, if women have traveled to those areas and not had symptoms, by the way, about 80% of patients may not have symptoms, it's recommended they undergo fetal sonograms to look for microcephaly or any of the brain calcifications.
It's always curious to me when these things emerge from the woodwork and then we start to identify that, wow, there's a relationship between this infection and fetal abnormalities. Where's it been? And what's the reservoir? Do we know any of this?
No, we're early in the outbreak, and so there's still a lot of investigation. And how did this association occur? Well, they noticed that, A, there was a Zika outbreak in Brazil, and the incidence of microcephaly and intracranial or brain calcifications rose dramatically. Again, because it's mosquito-borne and it's a virus, there's no treatment for it. And the prevention is to prevent mosquito bites, wearing long sleeve shirts or long pants, using insect repellent, and being in areas that are either air-conditioned or screened.
No question we're going to be hearing more about this. And of course, you and I, as consummate nerds, are so fascinated by the medical sleuthing that's required in order to figure out, well, all right, where's it come from? Where's it hiding? And what can we do about it? We'll look forward to that. Let's turn then to the British Medical Journal, something I served up as, wow, a common heart condition that turns out to be worse for women than men. That's atrial fibrillation.
And we say common. Worldwide, there are about 33 million individuals that have this, and the prevalence is increasing. It's associated with high blood pressure, heart disease, and just age. We know that in women, many of the traditional risk factors for heart disease actually have a higher risk for heart disease in women than in men. For example, diabetes. If a woman has it, there's a higher incidence or risk of heart disease. For smoking, a higher risk for women than for men. And the question is the same true for atrial fibrillation? Because that's associated with stroke. It's an irregular heart rhythm that increases the risk of stroke about two or threefold over the general population. These investigators reviewed all the studies in which there was a gender analysis with over 4 million participants. And what they discovered was there was a higher mortality in women than men, about a 12% higher mortality, about 100% increased risk of stroke, a 90% increase in cardiovascular death, and 55% increase in cardiac events altogether.
Clearly, where I'm going to head with this is, all right, what's the clinical management strategy then? And also, what about detection? Because, gosh, sometimes AFib gets poo-pooed as sort of maybe a consequence of aging, really not that traumatic a condition.
All right, so people that complain of palpitations should be examined for atrial fibrillation, especially the older population or those with other risk factors that I mentioned. The practical implications of this is that we decide whether to put someone on long-term anticoagulation, blood thinners, based upon what the risk of stroke is. Well, this suggests that gender ought to be one of the things that's put into the formula or the decision algorithm about whether we provide anticoagulation to people with atrial fibrillation. So one of the things we need to consider is being more aggressive in our treatment in women than in men.
Okay. Let's move from here then to something I thought was a little bit disappointing. Gosh, we've talked about once again something that seems, at least to me, and maybe this is just anecdotal, to be increasing in frequency. That's Parkinson's disease. And the whole constellation of things that impact on people who develop this. This was a study taking a look, and it was a little disappointing, at the impact of PT, physical therapy, and helping these people deal with that. That's in JAMA Neurology.
So these patients are typically put on medications and sometimes surgery to treat their Parkinson's disease. Unfortunately, it's an intractable disease. It is progressive despite therapy. And so the motor problems become more severe, interfering with gait, daily living activities, and ultimately can also be associated with dementia. Well, in these individuals that have mild to moderate Parkinson's, one might hypothesize that giving them physical therapy and occupational therapy early might improve their daily living activities and improve their quality of life. It seems intuitively obvious to me that that would be the case. Well, in this well-done study, in which they examined about 760 individuals with mild to moderate Parkinson's, half of them got randomized to physical therapy and occupational therapy. It was usually an hour, four times per week over a course of 3 months versus placebo, that is usual care. And unfortunately, what they found is that there really was no improvement with physical therapy or occupational therapy. Now, take a step back. That may be because there really is no benefit. It may be that it wasn't administered long enough. 3 months may have been too short a period.
But rather disappointing, as I suggested, because I know that, and one of the things that you didn't list as one of the consequences of Parkinson's is depression, of course. When I think about having compromised movement, that's one of the things that occurs to me almost right away. And if there was some way to slow that down or ameliorate it, I would really welcome that.
You know, one of the things that wasn't assessed in this, and it was alluded to in an accompanying editorial, is whether aerobic exercise can be beneficial. It appears to perhaps slow the progression. We know that that can improve depressive symptoms as well.
Finally then, let's turn to JAMA. And this was a theme issue. It was all about cancer care and cancer care at the end of life. So there are several studies that are in this issue. I'll let you pick the one that you'd like to serve up.
There are two. Let's just kind of combine them together. One looked at the family perspectives on aggressive cancer care near the end of life. And the other one compared healthcare utilization in 7 developed countries. And these were Belgium, Canada, England, Germany, the Netherlands, Norway, and the United States. Let's focus on the United States, which is where the podcast is originating. What we can say is that end-of-life care is more expensive in the United States than in most of these other countries. Healthcare in the United States near end-of-life is less hospital-centric, but they were more likely to be hospitalized in an ICU when that occurred. What do families think about that? Is this aggressive cancer care embraced by families, or is it thought to be detrimental? In the other study, authors interviewed 1,146 family members who had family members dying of advanced stage lung or colorectal cancer. And they looked at the different measures of aggressive end-of-life care. Were they put in an ICU? Were they repeatedly hospitalized or put in an emergency department? Here's what they discovered. Among the family members of older patients who died of lung or colorectal cancer, the perceptions of better end-of-life care is if the patient was enrolled in hospice and done so early, they avoided the ICU, there were fewer admissions within 30 days of death, and whether the death occurred at home. Those were the things that mattered most to the family members as representing better quality of care.
So I think some of these findings are really rather interesting. The one that you didn't mention and I'm going to mention was an analysis of what physicians themselves select at the end of life. All of these studies were really quite interesting in that the difference in what the United States spends versus other developed countries really was not that huge. And I thought it was going to be really a big, profound difference. And it really wasn't. The other thing was that while physicians choose less care at the end of life and fewer of them die in ICUs or in hospitals, that difference also was not as big as I would have predicted a priori. What do they suggest to you about end of life care?
Well, it's interesting because even though physicians for themselves pick less aggressive care and dying at home, that's not what they pick for their patients. The physician's perspective is that the family members want everything done, and the study shows that's not the case. So what this tells me is that we need to do a better job of ascertaining what the patient wants and being supportive of advanced care planning. Not waiting until the last moment, but finding out what do the patient and family want and what can I do to make that happen.
And now that that particular conversation is being reimbursed by Medicare, there's really fewer, at least, barriers to having that accomplished.
Many times it's talking about hospice earlier rather than later. As physicians, when we talk about hospice care, we feel like the patient and family may be feeling like we're giving up. When in essence, the patients often want to be involved with hospice care. They don't want to die in the hospital. They want to be at home with their loved ones, and we can help facilitate that.
All right. On that note, I think I will talk about the Zika virus this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.